Welcome to This Week in the Warner Archive Collection, where we discuss our newest releases. I'm George Feltenstein, and I'm proud to be joined by my colleagues, Matt Patterson and D.W. Ferranti. Sing hallelujah as there's a quintet of new additions to the ever-growing Warner Archive Collection. This week, we have a brand new to Blu-ray release. The phantasmagorical 1955 MGM spectacular Hit the Deck. Then we go to the era of television animation at its zenith with the great Johnny Quest and a new collection of Johnny Quest adventures from television. And then we have three films that were out of print on DVD that are back in print on DVD, courtesy of the Warner Archive Collection. We have Treasure Island, the 1934 version, with Wallace Beery and Jackie Cooper. We have Caged with Eleanor Parker. And from master disaster producer Irwin Allen, Beyond the Poseidon Adventure. So much to discuss. We have Warner Archive Instant Picks to tell you about the newest titles added to our subscription video on demand service that you can try for 2 weeks free on PC, Mac, Roku, or iPad, the latter two offering 1080p HD streaming. And we even have letters.
And one that's gigantic.
Let's get the fun underway and start talking about one of my most long-awaited additions to the Warner Archive Collection Blu-ray list. Based on the success we had of our past release, Performance, we wanted to have a film just like it.
Absolutely.
So I couldn't think of a film that was more similar in tone and feel to Mick Jagger and Performance than Jane Powell, Debbie Reynolds, Ann Miller, Vic Damone, Tony Martin, and Russ Tamblyn in Hit the Deck.
Well, lyrically, the song Hallelujah would actually suit the movie Performance, so I think you're on to something.
I think you could sing Hallelujah
Satan's
instead of
number, and that's the Funhouse number. Is that,
No.
Which one is that?
That Hallelujah
it's the
actually
open and the closer.
Opens
the
open
and closer.
And closes. The Funhouse number is done to various songs.
My gosh, because when you were saying Performance, my head went immediately to the Funhouse because that was surreal as anything. But we're really out to sea this week.
And the point should be made that the diversity of the kind of offerings that we're bringing to Blu-ray in Warner Archive, that we have one or two releases per month as well as animation. These are specially selected titles. And the next title that we'll be talking about will be more contemporary than Hit the Deck, and then we'll be going back to black and white. So there is always something bejeweled from the studio archives that we're bringing out to Blu-ray, and this slam bang all-star musical is about as different from Performance as you could get. But that speaks to our diversity, and in CinemaScope and 5.1 surround sound DTS HD Master Audio, it's a mightily impressive MGM musical.
Now, I'm going to go out on a limb and speak for the listeners when I say that no one really wants to hear us talk about an MGM musical, so I'm just going to pepper George with some questions.
Good.
Although I am going to take a moment out to note that genre fans should know that Richard Anderson and J. Carroll Nash are both in this film.
Richard Anderson, during his years as an MGM contract player, where you'll see him pop up in many, many films long before Oscar Goldman ever came to be.
Now, give us a history of the show and the movie, George.
Well, this has a very interesting lineage. Hit the Deck actually goes back to a musical that appeared on Broadway that was based on a play that appeared on Broadway called Shore Leave by Hubert Osborne, I believe it's 1925. And it was made into a silent film with Richard Barthelmess at First National, which became part of Warner Brothers, which I believe no longer exists, although I could be wrong about that. But we certainly don't have it in our holdings. But Hit the Deck appeared on Broadway as a hit musical in 1927, I believe. This is all by memory, so if I'm wrong out there, folks, forgive me. The score was by the great Vincent Newmans, who had had a massive success 2 years earlier with No No Nanette, and lyrics by Leo Robin and Irving Caesar. And the success of the Hit the Deck stage musical led nascent RKO to make a film version of Hit the Deck in 1930 which is no longer known to be in existence. Mm. And it starred Jack Oakey, and it had Technicolor. And MGM bought the property to remake it in 1947. But this film did not come out until 1955. So the intervening 8 years has an interesting history to it. But when MGM bought the RKO film to remake, and RKO was selling lots of its properties for other studios to remake, hence that's why MGM remade Little Women, so forth and so on, the Hit the Deck original negative, 1930, was delivered to MGM in 1947. What happened to it in the intervening years and why it's a lost film, we've never been able to figure out. So if anybody's got it in their basement, let us know, because we still have a valid copyright. But in any event, it took producer Joe Pasternak 8 years to get Hit the Deck from MGM purchasing the property to actually putting the movie on the big screen. And the primary stall for the reason I learned about when I was producing the soundtrack CD of this back in 2002 and going through all the research, the original sale of the Broadway musical restricted them to only using the songs that Vincent Humans had written for the Broadway score, that the Broadway score could not have other songs interpolated. Mm-hmm. And what MGM wanted to do, Vincent Humans isn't that well known now, unfortunately, but he wrote songs like I Want to Be Happy and T for Two, both of which were from No No Nanette. And the rest of his song catalog is featured in Hit the Deck. And that was MGM's intention, but that was not contractually possible. So it took a lot of years of haggling back and forth between MGM and Vincent Humans heirs, because by that time he had passed away, to finally get this done. Now, I also want to mention that if the plot seems a little tiny bit familiar, that there was another film made by RKO based on Shore Leave in 1935, that came out in 1936 with a score by Irving Berlin, called Follow the Fleet with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. So it's a cousin of Hit the Deck, and that is available from Warner Home Video on DVD. But Hit the Deck is finally what came to be on the big screen. It appeared at Radio City Music Hall and was really the last of its kind for that period. We talked about Jumbo, which is also available on Blu-ray from Warner Archive, as, you know, quote unquote, the last MGM musical. But this is from the time when they were making three or four a year in the Pasternak unit, Joe Pasternak being the producer, Arthur Freed being the other, the major musical producer at MGM, and also Jack Cummings to an extent. Joe Pasternak did one more big budget musical, which is part of the Warner Archive collection on DVD, Meet Me in Las Vegas. But that is a smaller budgeted sister compared to Hit the Deck, because you've got superstar power, superstar songs, great choreography from Hermes Pan. And so that is basically the backstory of this motion picture and how it came to be. So what did you think of it, especially on Blu-ray?
Oh, well, I mean, it looked fantastic. And it was also great because the theatricality of the presentation comes through in HD in a way that sort of gets blurred in SD. I mean, you can see the fine set work, and you also can see that they're not trying to make it not be a set.
Right.
Hit the Deck is the play within the show, within the movie. That's sort of what Dan was detailing. And then when I talked about going even into the carnival ride, like that surrealness, it wasn't, you know, it was evocative of a real carnival ride, but you knew you were in a musical and then outside. So, and then the dancing and the singing, it's not quite diegetic, but it's close. And that's sort of the interesting approach that you take. And the super wide screen is done with
CinemaScope.
Yeah. CinemaScope is very well used in the choreography.
They tell you that right after the movie starts, right after Leo. It's a big deal.
What was interesting, you know, its place is like sort of the last of the, or one of the last of the big movie musicals, is there's, in some of the musical numbers, even though Humans' music is old, there's some hints in the staging and the choreography of what, of the new musical.
Yep.
Like that Bayou number is very much like, oh, you see the beginnings of like West Side Story creeping in, things
and,
like that.
And the Bayou number, this is a song called The Lady from the Bayou. This has a very interesting pedigree because The Lady from the Bayou was a new song. Now, how could there be a new song if Vincent Humans had been dead And what happened was an unused melody from his trunk was set to Leo Robin, who was one of the original lyricists, wrote new lyrics for Lady from the Bayou. So they were able to create a new song from an unlyricized Vincent Newman's melody. And of course, you've got Ann Miller, the tap dancer, dancing barefoot, which is, and the choreography is by Hermes Penn, who is one of the great screen choreographers of all time and had done most of the Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers movies and had, in fact, done the choreography for Follow the Fleet. Ann Miller was a good friend of mine, and I actually got to meet Hermes Penn at dinner with Ann Miller, which was pretty awesome. Hermes Penn was afraid to fly, and he used to take the train. And the interesting thing was, when I had dinner with him, he had just survived a train crash where the train had derailed, and he had crawled out of the window. And he passed away after that, having nothing to do with the injuries of this train thing. But he looked a lot like Fred Astaire. And if you look at the early pictures of him working with Fred and Ginger, it's almost like his younger twin brother. And they were great friends. But his choreography on its own, he did My Fair Lady, he did Finian's Rainbow, he did so many other things. And Ann Miller used to always just say, oh, he's my great friend, you know. And he also did the choreography for Kiss Me, Kate. They worked together quite frequently. But the Funhouse number is really, let's talk about the cast here, because Russ Tamblyn is a wonderful match for Debbie Reynolds. They're a great romantic pair. And Russ Tamblyn wasn't a dancer.
Could have fooled me.
He was a tumbler.
Oh, there you go.
That's why he
And in Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, Michael Kidd was able to take advantage of his tumbling skills.
That's funny.
And it was built upon that. I mean, he moves well, but he will. And then, of course, he was in West Side Story. But he will be the first to tell you, and I had the pleasure of having lunch with him not too long ago, and that was really the first time we had met, that, you know, he felt a little out of place being in these big musicals, but he really holds his own.
And he's great.
The Funhouse number takes advantage of his tumbling skills, and it's different than a traditional.
It sets it apart. That's how come I zeroed right in on that, because it was unexpected.
So the basic story of Shore Leave and Hit the Deck is three sailors on leave looking for love. And you've got Tony Martin, who is the longtime boyfriend of Ann Miller, and she's tired of waiting for him to finally pop the question and marry her. You have Jane Powell as the daughter of Walter Pidgeon, who is the admiral in the Navy.
And sister of the Russ Tamblyn character.
Yes. And
they're all related.
So then you have Gene Raymond, the husband of Jeanette MacDonald, popping up as the lascivious older stage Lothario who tries to seduce poor young Jane Powell. And then you have Debbie Reynolds as the girl in the show, as Matt mentioned, Hit the Deck. And this is the third film that Jane Powell and Debbie Reynolds appeared in together. They were in 2 Weeks with Love, where they played sisters. And they also played sisters in 1954's Athena, which we're very proud of as one of our Warner Archive DVD releases. And a year later, Joe Pasternak brought them together again. And they both shared the same birthday of April 1st. So as this podcast is debuting on April 8th, along with Hit the Deck, we have to wish Miss Reynolds and Miss Powell a very happy birthday. They are both ladies who I've had the great pleasure to know personally and would love to wish them a happy birthday.
Did we mention Vic Damone?
We have to mention Vic Damone, because Vic Damone is wonderful in this movie. You've got two incredible singers. I mean, Vic Damone and Tony Martin. And Vic Damone had been with Debbie and Jane in Athena. So Vic Damone is the love interest of Jane Powell in Hit the Deck, whereas Vic Damone was the love interest of Debbie Reynolds in Athena. Are you keeping score, folks? And Jane Powell and Vic Damone had appeared together in Rich, Young, and Pretty, which is also available from Warner Archive. So there's a lot of familiarity amongst the people working here, and that shows in the first class production.
And tell us a little bit about Kay Armon, who plays Vic Damone's mother.
Kay Armon was a pop singer of the era, and Joe Pasternak, who produced the film, was very much wanting to take people he'd spot in pop music and find ways to put them in movies. And this is why you see Nat King Cole in Small Town Girl performing in a nightclub. You see the DeMarco sisters in Skirts Ahoy. And Kay Armon is playing Vic Damone's mother when, in fact, she was, I think, like the same age as Vic Damone. But I think the thing I want to mention about this is you've got one famous song after the other. You have songs like I Know That You Know, which was interpolated from another score, and Warner Archive fans will recognize that as the theme song for the Joe McDoakes shorts, which we have on Warner Archive in a wonderful set of shorts. So Hit the Deck is now in all its glory, 5.1 audio, looking fantastic on Blu-ray, and we urge you, if you're an MGM Musicals fan, you've been waiting for this, it's now available.
Speaking of hitting the deck, our next offering involves a lot of deck hitting, especially by Race Bannon. I'm talking about Johnny Quest, The Complete 80s Adventures, which is Hanna-Barbera, a full generation later, returned to the adventures of Johnny Quest for a new package for syndication. Johnny Quest, I mean, it's really worthy to note that after all that time, was still solidly in the popular imagination.
Johnny Quest was a one-season network primetime series on ABC that, not unlike the Jetsons or Top Cat, continued to live on and on and on with just a small number of episodes. I think it first went to CBS Saturday mornings, and it eventually bopped to all the networks in syndication, and then decades later, Hanna-Barbera rebooted the series. Obviously, Tim Matheson was too old to continue to do the voice of Johnny Quest, so there's a different voice artist performing the role.
And everyone's hair is longer, because even in animation, hairstyles change.
And hair grows in animation.
And these were initially syndicated to with the original ones to fill them out.
Correct. This was done so that you could syndicate a proper number of episodes to fill the time. And this is the same period of time that you see strip syndication shows,
right,
where advertising was bartered out to third parties. And you had cartoons produced specifically for daytime syndication with a certain amount of commercial time pre-sold. So by creating new Johnny Quest episodes, they could mix them with the old ones,
right,
and sell it as a syndication barter series.
And Dan, what would you say the main difference is between the 80s adventures and the ones from before?
Well, do you want a super nerdy answer?
I will give you my very
answer. You go ahead.
These feel like they're a little more kid-friendly, like, you know, in the intervening years. Some of the edges were sanded off, but in a way, a little more, I don't know, a different kind of surrealism.
The tone is different. The original Johnny Quest was very cinematic adventure. This is a fun science fiction adventure cartoon, and it has a Rockman sidekick that appears halfway through, voiced by Jeffrey Tambor. I bet you didn't know that.
I did, because I looked it up.
All right. I would love to see Jeffrey Tambor revisit the character of Hard Rock.
But Johnny Quest fans have been very, very supportive of previous releases, the Johnny Quest telefilms that we released from the 90s, and the Real Adventures of Johnny Quest, which was the emergent CGI series that would come later. But this middle series was the missing link, and we're happy to fill that link with this two-disc set that has all the episodes from the Complete 80s Adventures.
And if you're at all a fan of Hanna-Barbera and DC Animation, take a look at the credits. This is early work from people that would then really dominate, like Alan Burnett and Andrea Romano. They both worked on this show. And this is then you'll see an older name like Don Glute wrote an episode. So this is sort of very much a transitional show full of that Johnny Quest adventure.
What I also love about this series is, unlike other ones from this time, they almost felt they had license to go weird.
No, I mean, there's some really fun scripts in this.
To take my favorite one and to take the sea theme of today's podcast a little further was an episode called 40 Fathoms Into Yesterday, where they time travel to 1944.
Time travel Nazis, submarines, flying pygmies.
Yes.
And a dog bandit gets put in a chair and given a bone, and they worship him. So if you've ever seen Pirates of the Caribbean, draw your own conclusions.
Now, speaking of pirates, that's a perfect segue to our first title that we're bringing back into print as we hear Robert Louis Stevenson's immortal tale, Treasure Island, is now back in print on DVD, brought to life with Wallace Beery and Jackie Cooper. And this is a true bona fide 1934 MGM classic that people have been wanting to own again because it's been out of print for so long, and now it's back. And that's seafaring, if ever there was, wouldn't you say?
We've gone from sea to sea to sea. So far, the segways have been golden.
Oh. Well, I'm just going to hobble up to this one on my one good leg. The beginning of this, it starts off so good because Dr. Gillespie is there yelling at young Jack. To me, this is more like the book than some of the other
ones. I would agree, absolutely.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a great adaptation. To this day, I really think that Barry's Long John Silver is still the definitive one.
Absolutely.
I had great fond memories of this film and thought it would be great to watch it with my four-year-old. A little intense for her. So if you're a parent out there, you might want to wait till a little bit older before you give
Nine or ten, yeah. Not four.
And Dan, as an adult, you know, because I first read this story, you know, in elementary school. And of course, I identify with the young character.
Now you identify with Silver, because
yeah,
I do.
I do. And he is a really interesting character in this, because when you see him manipulating the circumstances, his moral ambiguity is really the shining light.
Well, it's more ambivalence than ambiguity. He really is a bad man.
Oh, he is bad.
But he's so implacably bad and charming that he gets a pass when he really shouldn't.
He's not trying to be charming. No. I mean, this is Wallace Beery. This is not Jack Sparrow.
This story has been filmed so many times, and probably the most recent one that I know of was recently issued by Warner Home Video, was the TNT production that starred Charlton Heston and a young Christian Bale. I don't think it's been filmed since then, but it very well might have, because when a literary work is classic and in the public domain like that, everybody starts to film it. And of course, we have another Treasure Island in from Warner Archive that's with Orson Welles. There's an animated one in our library. And then, of course, there was the Disney version in 1950. So this tale has been oft filmed, but I would agree that never better than in 1934. This is,
and it's just like the epitome of like an MGM production. You've got you know, Victor Fleming directing, you got Louis Stone, Nigel Bruce, Lionel Barrymore all supporting. Lionel Barrymore is particularly amazing as Billy Bones.
Everybody but L.B. Mayer's secretary, Ida Koverman, everybody on the lot was involved with this one. So, a true MGM classic, now back in print, Treasure Island, 1934.
Quick question. Location, as I was watching the film, did they shoot some of this in Catalina? Do you know?
My understanding is yes.
Okay.
It looks Catalina-y.
Okay.
But we're going to take a moment, just one moment in this podcast, to step on dry land with Caged from 1950, quintessential women in prison film.
The definitive women in prison film. Now, we have a quasi-remake of this. It's considered a remake, and I don't think it is. House of Women.
It is. No.
But
the
it
only
isn't.
Thing they have in common is a baby.
Yeah. Eleanor Parker was nominated for Best Actress, and Hope Emerson was nominated for Best Supporting Actress for this film, which was part of a Women in Peril collection of camp called Classics. But some people were not happy about this film being called camp because it really should be taken seriously on its own as a serious, fine film. There are aspects of it that are a little jocular, and they were then, but it was a very serious look for its time. We're looking almost 65 years ago.
I mean, this is
it's
like
extreme.
This is very much a film noir that's not a film noir.
Right.
We were calling it a noirigin story.
Yeah, because this is, not to spoil anything, but this is the origin of a femme fatale.
This is a film that has been out of print for quite some time, and people have been wanting to get it. And while our primary mission is to bring things out that have never been before available, things that haven't been available for a long time that people have been clamoring for, also warrant attention, and Caged is really at the top of the list. Yeah.
This is totally worth it. And I'd like to just also very quickly mention, similarly to Orange is the New Black, this got a nomination also for a screenplay. And the one writer who wrote the article it was based on, she actually got herself booked into prison, Virginia Kellogg. She got herself into prison, and she took notes the whole time on all the crazy stuff that was going on. And so that, you know, and so that's kind of why these characters are so sharp and so well drawn, because these weren't archetypes at this point. This was like original observations.
They were trying to do something that was groundbreaking and different, and that's why the film really has the vibrancy and life that it does so many years later. And Eleanor Parker, who just passed away recently, mm-hmm. this is one of her finest moments on screen, because she gives a great performance.
Transformation is pretty dazzling.
Yeah.
In a dark way. The direction by John Cromwell is really first rate. I mean, you can see that in terms of set-wise, he had mm-hmm. few locations, but he mm-hmm. used them and moved those camera around. I mean, it's prison. Of course, you have few locations. It's a very big film, even though it's very claustrophobic.
Now, our next film that is back in print, I would have to say that if it wasn't considered camp when it came out, it certainly is now. And that is the Irwin Allen megastar, mega spectacular, Beyond the Poseidon Adventure, starring Michael Caine, Sally Field, and a host of other greats.
This is known as being a goofy sequel, but it was really good. I think it's got an all-star cast. I was riveted to it. I mean, it's got some budget limitations.
The mistake they made was
not casting Shelley Winters.
Is the Poseidon Adventure, everyone who's seen the film still has that vivid imagery in their mind of the grime and the oil and the sweat and the sheen, because mm-hmm. you know, in Poseidon Adventure, those actors really went through a grueling experience.
Yes.
Beyond the Poseidon Adventure, it's a little cleaner.
It goes beyond.
But it is a crazy pulp adventure story that takes place on the sunken Poseidon.
Yeah, it's like they literally pick up, you know, after everybody's rescued.
Almost
everybody. Well, I didn't want to spoil too much, but you could guess that. Michael Caine and Telly Savalas lead dueling salvage sort of operations.
Yes, and this is a well-dressed Telly Savalas on a boat. So if you've seen French Atlantic Affair, you should be suspicious.
If you see Telly Savalas from the 70s getting on your cruise ship, if you have a time machine, get off.
And if he doesn't have a lollipop, get off.
But anyway, they go into the little hole that everybody came out of in the last movie. And there's all kinds of things inside. Fire, floods.
Maybe even the last print of Hit the Deck 1930.
That's,
I mean, anything is possible.
Anything could be done.
And Slim Pickens as a wine steward.
Oh,
one of the things that stirred up interest to us in terms of the cards and letters, and we'll be reading a letter shortly, and emails and social media outreach to us about titles people want to see back in print. One of the things that stirred up Beyond the Poseidon Adventure coming back in print was its placement within Warner Archive Instant.
That's right.
Our still new subscription video on demand series that you could try for 2 weeks free on your PC, Mac, Roku, Roku Stick, or iPad. And Roku and iPad streaming is very often 1080p HD. And once you subscribe, you're going to be a subscriber forever, because you're going to love the rare and hard-to-find motion pictures and television shows that are there. And we have a lot of new additions to Warner Archive Instant. Every week, we're always adding new content. And today, we're going to share some of our favorite picks with you.
My pick is the 1935 Midsummer Night's Dream, chiefly because it's a great movie. I mean, if you're a giant Shakespeare fan, as I am, it's not Shakespeare, but it's a great movie. It's got great performances. It has Jimmy Cagney as Bottom, and Mickey Rooney is amazing as Puck.
And Mickey Rooney was borrowed. I think he was either borrowed from MGM or had yet to get under contract to MGM, but this is really right on the cusp of his stardom.
I couldn't think of an actor more Pucky.
The film is full of great performances. You know, Olivia de Havilland, Dick Powell, but this kid steals the screen every time he's on it.
Yeah.
This was a very prestigious Warner Brothers production that actually was based on Max Reinhardt's stage production that had appeared at the Hollywood Bowl and as staged by Max Reinhardt. And Jack Warner would make these films that were gangster pictures and people of the street and social pictures, but he also would make a prestigious picture every once in a while that spoke to history. Anthony Adverse with Frederick March would follow the following year. Story of Louis Pasteur would win the Oscar for Best Actor for Paul Muni the following year. And The Life of Emile Zola would win Warner Brothers its first Best Picture in that Academy Award in 1937. So making prestigious historical pictures and big budget pictures was part of the Warner scheme of 52 films a year. But Midsummer Night's Dream was so special that they even made a featurette, which is on the DVD, which is still available, called The Dream Comes True, because putting Midsummer Night's Dream on the screen for all to see, those who couldn't see it on stage, was a dream come true for a lot of people, including Olivia de Havilland, because she was in that stage production and she got her Warner Brothers contract and eventually got to play opposite Errol Flynn and Captain Blood shortly thereafter. And one of the most wonderful things about Midsummer Night's Dream is the amazing score
by
Wolfgang Korngold.
I saw a film on the instant lineup that I had been forbidden to see as a kid. You know, whenever I see those things, I go, oh, I actually never have seen this. And that was 1980's Private Benjamin. I was allowed to see the TV version, but I was never allowed by my mom to see the theatrical version, and I found out why. It's a pretty funny fish out of water comedy, you know, institutional comedy, stars Goldie Hawn.
Now, why?
Why does it star Goldie Hawn?
No, why weren't you allowed to see it?
What
did you find out? Because
I'm going to get into it. Well, in the very early scene, her pampered life is thrown into disarray. On her wedding night, in the act of coitus, it is interrupted by her new groom dying of a heart attack. And that would have been too much for me as a child.
So your mother felt you weren't ready to know about heart attacks?
Yes, okay. That there is correct.
There you go, that makes sense.
Because that went through. But I was allowed to see the TV version. But it's a funny show. It was a funny movie. It was in HD. And I, of course, love any sort of epic standing up against the man kind of comedy.
And speaking of standing up against the man, a very manlike performance in terms of what the military asks for is given by Eileen Brennan, who I believe was nominated for Academy Award.
She was, and she went on to do the TV version.
And she is in the TV version, which co-starred Lorna Patterson.
And I think at the time, you know, in 1980, women in the military was a new thing. I think in 75, right. They were just starting to allow women to come in. So this was also one of those funny cultural points where people are like, women in the military? And I think that this movie was popular enough, you know, that...
This movie was a huge hit.
And this actually is kind of one of those things that changed people to be like, yeah, why not women in the military?
Goldie Hawn was one of the biggest movie stars of the era, having come off movies like Foul Play. And this movie was one of the biggest hits of its time. And that time was 34 years ago, which makes me feel like I'm ready to go to the old age home. But in any event, I heartily endorse your selection. I have a double selection. Both of these movies begin with K. Both of these movies are in HD. Both of these movies feature the ever elegant George Sanders. And they're both titles that you can buy on DVD from the Warner Archive Collection, but now you can watch them in HD on Warner Archive Instant. And that is King Richard and the Crusaders and The King's Thief. So I'm picking two. I know I'm only allowed to pick one, but I had to pick two.
But you got King in both of them.
Because
and
you got
Sanders.
These are costume epics set in England with great performances from great stars. King Richard and the Crusaders, we can talk about it. We talked about it on an earlier podcast, but you've got Rex Harrison, you've got Virginia Mayo, you've got a very young Lawrence Harvey, you've got CinemaScope. You've got great battles, and it looks spectacular and wonderful stereophonic sound. And that's from 1954. Warner Brothers, a year later, you have Edmund Purdom and David Niven, and of course, George Sanders and Blythe, and a wonderful, wonderful and daring do.
And a young Beau Maverick.
And that's right, Roger Moore, there he is again. 1955's The King's Thief, which tells a wonderful, fun tale in the short running time of 79 minutes, which is elegant filmmaking at its most efficient. But these two epic tales are now streaming in 1080p HD on Warner Archive Instant. You can't see them in 1080p anywhere else. So by all means, if you haven't signed up for your two-week free trial, and if you're not a member of Warner Archive Instant, you cannot consider yourself a true movie fan.
If you are a member, just keep tuning in because things change every week.
We're always adding new content.
The fun thing to do with Instant, and I don't know if you guys do this as much as I do, but I'll just start stuff. I just go in and I start it and I'll watch 5-10 minutes. I'll be like, oh, that was fun. Oh, what's next? Because there's so much in there, I can't stop. Okay, maybe I'm just crazy.
No, you're not crazy because it's all you can eat. It's hundreds of movies. And I think you make a very good point because we have hundreds and hundreds of movies and hundreds of hours of television programming. That may seem like a small number compared to the thousands of movies you've never heard of that are on big services. But what we have to offer is absolutely choice and pre-selected and pre-vetted for your entertainment approval. And you're not going to be able to resist the choices in Warner Archive Instant.
Well, after I get over my ADD attack, I could also write us a letter. Oh, because we have a mailing address and we take letters. Here, that
was the best stamps on them.
Yeah. And also, I was told recently on Twitter that I do not enunciate well enough for most people to get this address. So I'm going to give out the address very, very clearly today and let you know where you can send your missive. Warner Archive Collection, B as in boy, 160-8 as in the number 8, 3400, that's 3400, Riverside Drive, Burbank, California, 91522.
This week we have a very special letter. We actually have a package.
This is giant. I'm holding this up and shaking it. This is from Craig from New York, New York. It's a box and it was insured, but of course it's partially open.
Yeah, Craig, someone in the post office or maybe someone in the building got a little curious. It looks like they took a knife to it. So we'll evaluate the contents. You might want to collect on that insurance.
And you know, we didn't movie box this, meaning like, you know how you can just pop open the top like it's a bad TV show? Oh boy, look at that. Okay, these are books. Oh, that's why it's so heavy. We each get a beautiful Muppet character encyclopedia.
Awesome.
Thank you, Craig.
Thank you, Craig.
And here we go. Dear Warner Archive folks, since you guys have been so generous with the gifts that you sent me, given me in person at New York Comic Con, and even given to me via my wife, Stephanie, at Comic Con in San Diego, you may recall she was there to promote the puppet version of Scooby-Doo in which she played Velma. I am enclosing a signed copy of my new book, The Muppets Character Encyclopedia, for each of you. I'm also enclosing a self-addressed stamped envelope so we can keep the gift exchange going. I'm no fool.
Check out these awesome stamps.
Oh, those are good.
Katharine Hepburn, Bo Jess, Stagecoach, Gone with the Wind, Wizard of Oz, and Bob Hope.
I continue to enjoy both the DVDs you release and Warner Archive Instant. I especially like watching the short-run TV series like The Jimmy Stewart Show and The Practice, and hope to see more TV there from the WB and MGM library. Any possibility of adding unsold pilots? Recently, I was selected by TCM, another part of the Warner family, as one of their ultimate fans, and I had the pleasure of joining Robert Osborne as a guest programmer, and I invite you and your listeners to tune in on April 7th at 9:45 as we introduce the Warner Archive instant classic, A Face in the Crowd.
Good choice.
Of course, since you tape your podcast in advance, it's entirely possible that this has already happened. In which case, I assure you, I was wonderful. Thanks for doing what you do. Best regards, Craig. Well, gosh, Craig, this is very generous. Thank you for this lovely book. What about pilots? What about unsold pilots?
We have unsold pilots that will be appearing in, well, we actually have an unsold pilot in Warner Archive Instant. Right now we have two of them because we have Planet Earth and we have Genesis 2.
That's right.
So they're pilots in the form of television movies that were anywhere from 66 to 72 minutes or even 96 minutes long. So we have a few of them already and we will be adding more.
All right, we've got one more letter. This is from Raquel from Woburn, Massachusetts.
Woburn. Woburn.
What do I know? I'm not from there, Dan.
Would you pronounce Worcester next? Or Gloucester,
like the cheese?
Spencer Tracy did.
Oh, well, what do you get? Okay, this is hand letter. Dear George, Matt, and DW, my original letter never made it to you.
Oh, yeah. Yes, and we're sorry about that.
So I'm mailing it again. I'm a big fan of the actress Sandra Dee, and I particularly enjoyed her film from 1967, Doctor, You've Got to Be Kidding. It's got a great cast, including your favorite character actor, Alan Jenkins, a silly plot, and is overall, it's wonderful, light 1960s fun. I was hoping this one might be in your archives because it's an older MGM film. Is there any chance that this film might be released on DVD from Warner Archives sometime in the future? Also, perhaps you could explain to folks like myself who are still trying to figure out the ins and outs of classic film distribution, what Warner Archive owns the rights to and what you do not. Thank you for all you do at Warner Archive. I've been a big fan since your launch 5 years ago, and I'm forever indebted to you for releasing Bachelor Mother, 1939. I bought that one right away, and it's one of my most treasured possessions. Keep up your great work, especially with your social media and your wonderful podcast, which is consistently entertaining and informative. Thanks, Raquel. Hi, Matt. She wrote that there.
Is that your mom?
Yes. She's constantly writing in from Massachusetts.
You know, I mean, it's so personal, so friendly.
She says hi, Matt, because we've talked on Twitter before.
Aha. Uh-huh. My goodness. Well, I hope it was in the requisite amount of characters.
Yeah, all within 140.
There we go. Well, I can answer two questions. The infamous Doctor, You've Got to Be Kidding is not available on DVD because we do not currently have a 16x9 letterbox master, and we do not release films unless we can do so in the proper aspect ratio. The good news is that we will be remastering Doctor, You've Got to Be Kidding, and it will eventually be joining the WAC lineup in a new proper 16x9 letterbox master in the original aspect ratio as originally intended by the director of this cinematic masterpiece. It is a lot of fun, and it does have Alan Jenkins, and it had another working title, which I don't recall at this moment, but I remember going through some of the MGM documentation, and it had a more simple title, but I think they wanted to push the envelope a little bit and make it seem a little bit more racy.
It was also the era of long titles with question marks.
That's true. Where were you when the lights went out?
What's new?
But in any event, we have a lot of films because many, many MGM films from the 60s and 70s, and this will get us to ownership in a minute, mm-hmm. that are part of our library, were mastered for television in the 80s and 90s. In 4x3 form, if they were done in letterbox at all. And that may be acceptable for some to put on a DVD, but not for Warner Archive, even in from our very inception. If we couldn't do it in the original aspect ratio, we weren't going to do it at all. Thankfully, we began remastering films after our first year. We've now been remastering films for 4 years. And Doctor, You've Got to Be Kidding, Yes, I'm Not Kidding, will be among those that we'll be remastering in the not-too-distant future, and you'll be able to own it in its lovely widescreen form. So, to that point, what is our library? Well, our library is the largest in the industry, and by and large, it is all Warner Brothers motion pictures, both past, present, and future, and those being the ones that we put into Warner Archive on DVD or streaming or what have you. And MGM Films produced and released up through the end of April 1986. From May 1986 onward, MGM Productions are owned by the current company that's called MGM. But we, Warner Brothers Entertainment, Inc., are the successor in interest to what was Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer up until April 1986. So the last MGM movie that is in our library is the beloved Warner Archive release, Killer Party. But do not judge based upon that, because there are nearly 2,000 other features and thousands of short subjects and cartoons that and thousands of hours of television that comprise that amazing library. So upon Time Warner's purchase of Turner Broadcasting, those assets became part of the Warner Brothers Entertainment Library, and we take great care of them and are constantly remastering them. So MGM up through April 1986, that's where that comes in. And then we have the RKO library and films that RKO produced that they didn't sell off to remake and that they didn't distribute on behalf of other people are basically owned by us, at least for home video in the United States. And those films are our pleasure to bring to you. We also have the Lorimar Library, and Lorimar had bought Allied Artists, which had changed its name from Monogram Pictures. And a lot of Monogram and Allied Artist films got sold off over the years, but what wasn't sold off, that was still part of the library when Lorimar acquired it. And we acquired Lorimar in the late 80s, and so that's part of our library. And many, many independent productions, along with hours and hours of television. So that's what makes up our library. And if you can keep score of all that nice and easy, then you get an extra special thank you from us.
Dan and I just want to throw in a few others for fun. Dan, yes?
Well, Hanna-Barbera.
Absolutely.
Well, I thought we were talking about theatrical features.
I said library.
But library, yes. Hanna-Barbera, of course, was acquired by Turner Broadcasting in 1982, along with the Ruby Spears Library.
Right.
Because Ruby Spears and Hanna-Barbera were both part of Taft Entertainment, and Turner bought those companies, and therefore that became part of our library, along with. And then, of course, Castle Rock and New Line were also part of the Turner Filmed group of companies, all of which are known corporately internally as the Turner West assets.
There's so much in there, and Dan and I always have fun trying to string the little pieces together because it gets even more obscure when you get into these like little indie libraries. Like you were telling me a few years ago about the whole history of the Brute Library.
That's only a handful of films,
right.
But that was actually a group of independent films that Ted Turner bought 5 years before he bought MGM. And then 5 months after Ted Turner bought MGM, he sold the name MGM and the production company assets of movies that were in production at the time back to Kirk Kerkorian, and that led to what is now the current MGM company. But the library is what he retained, and the library is what we obtained in the purchase of Turner Broadcasting by Time Warner in 1996 and has been part of Warner Brothers Entertainment ever since.
Okay, you got that, everybody?
So if you're still with us, this is my chance to put a quick plug. If you want to nominate someone to receive a Jenkins, write to me at thealanjenkins@gmail.com. Any actor you feel is unrecognized and unrewarded for superior service to cinema is available for nomination.
Do you have a few good nominations already?
I leave that up to the people.
I was just curious as to how it was coming along.
I know those cards and letters have been dibbling in.
Okay, that wins.
So that about wraps up this week's podcast, but don't worry because we'll be back next week with a slew of new releases being added to the Warner Archive Collection on disc and to Warner Archive Instant on our new SVOD service at WarnerArchiveInstant.com. On that note, I'm George Feltenstein.
I'm Matthew Patterson.
I'm very pleased with this Muppets Encyclopedia.
Thanks for listening. Look for the next Warner Archive Collection podcast.